Welcome to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent, documentary, and foreign films, every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific and online at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. Holding Back the Tide is an impressionistic hybrid documentary that traces the oyster through its many life cycles in New York, once the world's oyster capital. Now, their specter haunts the city through queer characters embodying ancient myth, discovering the overlooked history and biology of the bivalve that built that city, and that is New York City. And we're joined today by the director of this wonderful documentary film called Holding Back the Tide, Emily Packer. Emily, welcome to Film School Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so very much for being here. As I said before we got started, it's a beautiful film to look at. There's so much about the film that I thoroughly enjoyed. What was it that put you on to this idea? I had no idea that oysters were such an integral part of New York's history. For that alone, I appreciate this film, but there's so much more here. What put you on to doing this?
Well, I had been doing some research for a film, a short film called By Way of Canarsie that I made with Leslie Steele. And we had been sort of prompted by a fellowship that we were a part of to look into transit. And we were thinking about all of the resources that New York City was willing to invest in itself for short-term solutions. And I started wondering, well, what is it willing to do in the long term? And it was around this time that I learned about the oyster and learned about its rehabilitation. That's when I started looking into the history. And I read this great book by Mark Kurlansky called The Big Oyster, which really outlines how the city and the oyster are pretty inseparable.
Yeah, I had no idea. And we're not talking a small bit, trivial bit of New York City history. It is, by the documentary's account, a significant part of the foundational part of New York City. And I want to explore the various and many aspects of what that meant for the people who are working in the industry and so on. So tell me, how much of that surprised you? I mean, how much did you know going into this about that?
Luckily, we had a large research process. So by the time we actually started filming, I knew quite a bit. And part of that was influenced by COVID-19 coming into play and sort of cutting us off from being able to launch into production too quickly. So we had a long research period. I think one thing that really surprised me was just how foundational the oyster is, not just in terms of building the economy, but the literal materials of Lower Manhattan. So one of the first scenes that we shot was taking one of our sort of ghost-like trans characters around to the sites that we know are built out of literal oyster shells. And so that's Trinity Church, that's Pearl Street, there's all sorts of physical history. And then one thing that really surprised me to learn was that there are still middens, meaning large piles of shells that are left over from the times when the Lenape were stewarding the land, that are not very far from the city. And so getting to witness that, to sort of experience the physicality of that history today, was really shocking.
And I mentioned in the introduction the queer characters who embody this ancient myth of the oyster and its production and such. That ties into the biology of the oyster, which I had no idea. See, there's an educational level here going on with oysters and obviously the history of, but tell us about that. Tell us about the biology, the physiology, the sexuality of an oyster.
Yeah, that was definitely another sort of shock. And it was really our creative entry point into the process when we found out that oysters, by necessity, change their sex depending on what's needed and sort of depending on what they desire. From what I can tell, you know, the oyster doesn't have a central nervous system, so it's not a thinking animal necessarily. And in fact, whether it's, you know, an animal or a plant, bivalves sort of sit in between these two things, depending on who you ask. But it seems to me that the only things that really the oysters choose are where they land to spend their lives and what gender they are at any given time. And those two things to me were very inspirational in thinking about transness and thinking about queerness, especially in New York City and especially in our current political climate, to start to imagine seeing gender fluidity not as something separate from nature, but actually as something that's totally integral to this ecosystem builder that is foundational for this whole area. And so we started seeing transness as a huge power and something that we could really learn from.
And I'm not an expert, so if I come off as sounding like I know anything that I'm talking about here, but a little bit of research, or actually a documentary film that I saw not terribly long ago about seahorses.
Oh yeah, seahorses are cool. I mean, there's so many examples of especially underwater, but also above ground, like all sorts of ways that nature is, you know, not bound to our like human heteronormative understanding of what is supposedly natural. And seahorses are great. The males are the ones that give birth, that carry the beings to term. And oysters, I believe the term technically is prodantric, where they start out as male and then transition to female, but they can actually switch back and forth depending, again, on like what's needed, how many of sperm or eggs are needed in the water. They really are very adaptive.
To maintain the integrity of the population, they change according to the needs of the general society. Maybe that's a stretch to say society, but some version of.
We really are stretching it in this movie, so I think that's totally appropriate and well said.
And I want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Emily Packer. She's the director of this terrific new documentary film called Holding Back the Tide. Emily, when is Holding Back the Tide going to be available?
Well, we are about to launch a theatrical tour of this project, of this film. And so starting September 6th, we are premiering in New York City at DCTV's Firehouse Cinema. We'll be there for about a week. And then I am coming with the film to LA in the start of October at the Lemley Theaters. That will be in early October, starting as early as October 2nd. And then I'm sort of working on programming the film in other cities across the U.S., just one night only sort of events.
Where can people go to the website? Let's send them there.
Oh, sure. The website is holdingbackthetidefilm.com. And we've got a bunch of screenings that we are updating on there regularly.
Okay. And it's being released through Grasshopper Films. And I just love them. They're such a great distributor. They're just quality films all the way through. And by the way, the Firehouse Theater that you're talking about, that's John Alpert's outfit, who just such a terrific supporter of documentary filmmakers in general, and just been tireless in his efforts to make sure that films that don't often get an opportunity to be seen, he's been a real champion for that.
Totally. Yeah. We're so thrilled to be at DCTV. And we actually did a preview screening there right before the film was finished in order to sort of get audience reactions. And it was so fulfilling to see the film in that theater environment and to get that support from John and from all the folks at DCTV. And so to bring it back as this finished, beautiful film feels really special.
Now let's talk about the history of oyster harvesting and I'll call it production, and how that ties into the racial history of New York, the as I said in the introduction, the foundational part of the history of New York City, which I just, that was an utterly mind-blowing part of the film.
Yeah, I mean, oysters, they're sort of an ancient crop, right? But in terms of their history in New York, the Lenape people who were, as I said, stewarding the land before colonization were eating them as a delicacy. So the history stretches, you know, further back than the States, of course. There was a community of freed African-American slaves who came up from the Carolinas with their craft of harvesting and caring for the oysters and established one of the first freed communities of Black people and that was at Sandy Ground, which is at the southernmost tip of Staten Island, where some of the film takes place. And so there's always in New York been this tie between oysters and Black entrepreneurship and freedom and this sort of self-sufficiency. And so we tried to nod to that history in the film based on our casting and what we were, you know, exploring in terms of the archive. There were also, there's a huge immigrant history with in terms of the folks who were working in factories on Long Island, who were shucking and harvesting and canning the oysters that were one of the first large exports out of the area. So it really is pulling in a diverse community in terms of whose hands were actually the ones that were feeding us the oyster.
Amazing people that you brought in. I want to make sure I get the names correctly. Moody Harney, who is the real mother shucker of the film, who is just such a vibrant personality, such a wonderful, not only a guide into this history, but just as someone who is so outgoing and able to pull people into this story in his own way. A lot of very interesting other people. But let's start with Moody because he's just such a bright personality and his involvement in the film.
He was very influenced by early oyster history in New York and started his business, The Real Mother Shuckers, as a cart, as like a mobile cart, bringing back the sort of original street food feel of the oysters back to, you know, the streets of Brooklyn. And a huge part of his inspiration was in encouraging Black folks to try oysters again, because I think in our connotations of it and in its accessibility with in terms of price and all of that, like it has sort of left the community in some ways. And he wanted to bring it back to the streets, back to the people, and introduce it to folks in a way that would be exciting and fun and not so scary, which I think oysters sometimes can be if you don't have experience with them. And yeah, he's just such a gem, so funny. And now he actually has a brick and mortar place now and he's been written up by the New York Times. He's really a character and everybody feels that magnetism around him. So we were lucky that he wanted to collaborate with us for this.
Yeah. He just pulls you right into whatever he's talking about. He just has that bright personality. He approaches people all throughout we see him throughout the film, approaching them and sort of as the ambassador, as the evangelizing the value of oysters. Sue Wicks, the film opens with her and at her oyster farm. And I just fell in love with her. She's just such the people in the film are very committed to oysters, to the value of oysters and the environmental. By the way, another part, oh my God, it blew my mind again in the film, the importance currently, but the future importance of oyster production for our race, for human life. If you want to talk about Sue Wicks and anyone else in the film there are just so many people like that.
When you get into the oysters, you'll find a lot of passionate people, folks who are all about sort of like the nutritional value of it or the like sommelier type, like the taste of them. And Sue is really wonderful. She actually is a former WNBA player who has sort of retired to the sea in a way. And she's really at home there. And just, I think everyone falls in love with her in this film. She's so calm and thoughtful and really helps us sort of understand why folks have a near spiritual connection to the oyster. And yet the environmental stuff, essentially oysters are filtering water. That's what they do. That's how they receive their nutrients. And so wherever oysters are being farmed, they are filtering that water and they're also creating habitat. So there's more biodiversity, there's cleaner water. It is a net positive to farm oysters. There are so few crops like that, other than like seaweed, I think, that, you know, Sue also has started farming, where actually by putting your crop into the environment, you are improving it. And by replenishing that resource, you're improving the area where you are making an impact. And the big thing in New York is that the oyster beds at the bottom of the harbor, in addition to filtering the water and creating habitat and creating biodiversity, they were also protecting our shores from damage from large storms. They are breakwaters of sorts. And so once we overfished them and polluted the waters and the oysters had reached an ultimate decline, our shoreline became a lot more vulnerable to flooding. And so that's the impetus for some of the larger organizations that are attempting to replenish the oysters, not necessarily as a product to consume, but as its sort of original purpose in the ecosystem to preserve, to protect, to, you know, to produce this landscape.
And if anyone who is listening to this conversation is interested in some way of finding out more about oysters, watch Holding Back the Tide. That's one place to start. But also 1 billion oysters. Do I have that right? 1 billion oysters?
Yeah, there's a project called the Billion Oyster Project, and they've have many, many strands of how they are attempting to put 1 billion oysters into the harbor. And so we also worked with them in the film, but they have way more going on than we could possibly cover. They even have an educational platform. They have a school that they run. It's really impressive.
And for that organization, there's a lot of work to be done in educating people about oysters, because most people are like me, never given much thought to oysters. But I'm telling you, if you watch Holding Back the Tide, you will never look at oysters the same way you did before.
And sort of the filmmaking part of it, I love the tone of it. I like the feel of it. This just has a very fluid, maybe an appropriate word, fluid feel to the way that we transition from one subject, one part of the story to another. And I just in terms of the filmmaking, it's just a really, I'll say, easy watch. But it's also all the other things that we've been talking about. So my congratulations to you in terms of how the film feels. You want people to feel this film as much as to take it in and understand what you're talking about. Is that being fair?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. We really wanted to make something that felt cinematic and that drew you into emotionally thinking about these various aspects of, you know, the history, the culture, the environment, and how much someone can understand from the film. That was a delicate balance that we worked out of, you know, how much can we be didactic about what you're learning without falling into the tropes of how can I say this? Like, without being boring. We really wanted to entertain folks. We wanted them to feel something. We wanted them to walk out of the theater with a real experience that changed them. And I think being able to do that in a hybrid, low to no budget film, get to have that experience and to watch audiences have that experience, it's very affirming.
Well, and the cinematography as well is very, very well done. So director of photography was John Marty, and he just did a wonderful job.
Yeah, he and I have been collaborators for over a decade, actually. And it's really great to grow together like that. And yeah, we had a number of different folks that lent their talents to the creative side of it. And he just shines. So beautiful to watch. I agree. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you so very much for Holding Back the Tide. You not only are the director of the film, but also one of the producers, one of the writers.
Anything else?
What I will admit to is being in the film in a couple of different scenes. And the fun fact one is that I was actually working at the Union Square fish stand at the farmer's market when we shot that scene. And so one of the employees that's slinging the fish and selling the oysters is me.
Well, congratulations on Holding Back the Tide. So on September 6th, which is today, you'll be able to check it out at the DC Firehouse Theater, John Alpert's Outfit, starting today. And Emily was saying that we can be looking for this in early October out here in Los Angeles at one of the Lemley theaters. So I'll be looking for it there. And you can go to holdingbackthetidefilm.com is where you can go to find out more. Producer, director, and writer, Emily Packer, thank you so very much for your time today here on Film School Radio.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you.
You've been listening to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films. You can find out more about the program at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Caspar. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week with another edition of Film School Radio.